All right, it's time for us to enter back into the text of Numbers in the 6th chapter. So if you could open your Bibles, find a spot to prepare yourself to study. We will be digging into the second section of chapter 6 here in just a second, picking up towards the very end of it, and then we'll probably also be looking a little bit into the 7th chapter tonight as well. Before we get into our Bible study tonight, though, if you would bow with me in prayer, we'll use that to begin our study. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time we share together in study and consideration of your Word. We hope as we approach your throne and we approach you that we do so with holy hearts that are purified for study. Help us to not only understand the basics of your Word, but to learn to apply it in the challenging aspects of our life, to learn to be kind and generous when the world spits its evilness upon us. Please help us to grow and to be more like your Son, and we ask this prayer in his name. Amen. All right, so this section of Numbers, particularly the middle section of the last part of these verses, 22 to 27, contain within it one of the more powerfully memorable sections of Numbers to me. It's sometimes termed in a number of aspects, but this is the blessing of Aaron that is the center point of this last text. And it comes in an interesting spot, and we'll get into a little bit more about it in its bigger context in a second. But pause and reflect for a moment about one key factor that's really significant right now. That is, this is the Israel that is preparing to depart. They have been, in essence, kind of milling around outside the reception of the law, if you will, for quite some time. They've gone through that initial transformation of moving from Egypt to the edge, if you will, of a promised land. And as they've now had God provide to them a stable spiritual law, they've begun to make those initial preparatory steps to move forth. And we're going to move eventually into some very familiar Bible passages, some familiar stories. But right here is a blessing of Aaron. Now, Aaron is both very visible in the Old Testament, but ask yourself, how much do we actually know about him? Do we know a lot about his family in the sense of the way he moves and thinks? Do we see a lot of his emotions displayed for us? He's very visible, but he's almost like just presented to us as part of a backdrop. It's part of a bigger scene where other players in God's great work, we see more dimensions of them. We see their hearts. We see the inside of their inner workings in some way. And Aaron, he is more shown to us primarily, at least what I've noticed and noted for us tonight, is in two ways. The first way we encounter him is as a family member. And what part of the family is he, shown to be connected to? Moses. But how well do they know each other from their childhood? Do they grow up together? They have stories from their youth? No? Bobby? Yeah, just a little while, but not really in the memory-making portion of your life. Yeah, they would have a shared heritage that way. But does Moses have a respect for his ability? So somehow Moses knew about his brother's capacity. That's not revealed to us how he knows that either. Well, there's a God connection there, but there's a little bit of that. But we still don't get a whole lot. So on that one level, we have this very vague, thin family link. Almost everything else, with the exception of his sons and that dynamic there where we see his heartbreak, He's basically presented in his role. Whether it was the initial spokesman role, which he didn't really actually do much spokesmanning, whatever that is, the made-up word, so it counts now, or the high priest, which he did a lot. But again, we see him in the role, we lose sight of the man. So even though this is keyed to us and reminded to us as an Aaronic blessing, it comes forth, though, as the statement of God to him. We're going to pick up here in the text, verse 22, it reads, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, Thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up His countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put My name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them." Now, I tried really hard to memorize that in Hebrew and say it for y'all, and that didn't work. That was a non-starter 100%, because it sounds much different. Yeah, well, unfortunately, I would. And that would stop me just on that standpoint. But there's some power to the terms that are there. And in the driving force is that Aaron is again showed to us in his role. But his role here is serving in many of the same ways that he always does. He is blessing Israel, but he's doing so as a servant to bring health and security to all of God's people and telling them, in essence, God told me to tell you this. A lot of times you look at a passage like this and we highly personalize it to the person speaking. Well, here's Aaron and his sons, and they're saying, "The Lord bless you and keep you." So that must mean that Aaron's telling them this is his expectation for them. That's not the case. And actually, in most of the blessings that come from the high priestly role status are God speaking through him. So in this case, when you read this one, and we sing it a lot, right? I can't remember the name of the song, number of the song, but 7:10. We sing it. And we now cannot, at least I cannot, read the words without having the pacing of the melody going through my head. It's powerful in that sense as they are about to leave a very safe and newly familiar place to them. You know, they had gone from insecurity, but familiarity in Egypt to far more security now, a little bit more familiarity, but a whole lot more uncertainty. And so God, through His servants, is reminding them of at least one simple truth. And we're actually going to break down a few more in this passage. Is that He's still with them. When they leave their safe enclave, their safe little toes at the base of the mountain, they're going to be okay. Do they actually move forth that level of confidence? Because they struggle certainly on the first expectations of the journey as they get closer and closer to God's plan for them. I've said it before, as they basically bounce off God's gift. The land was promised to them. They get to the edge, and they're like, "Oh, we can't go in there. We can't pierce through this bubble of great might and strength. We're too small. We're too little." Another thing that's powerful in this text is how much is contained in just a few translated words. Know this, the word count in Hebrew is even less. They had to add a couple words to make the sentences right. But you think about a note like this given to us, how much richness of idea is conveyed? Well, it only becomes rich if we're mindful or aware of the rest of God's story. Without the rest of God's story, this sounds kind of hollow. If we don't know about what God can do, if we didn't know that He was the creator and sustainer of the universe, if we didn't know how He had rescued Israel out of captivity, then our attitude would be more in line with the Pharaoh. Who's this God again? Pharaoh's dad was very negative. Who is the Lord that I should obey his face, his voice? But in this case, if there's nothing to back it up with, then it seems pretty thin. But the more you understand the depth of God's care, you understand that this offer is a lot more substantial. Because you think about it in a very simple way. If you have the option of being in the inheritance of me and be added to my will, financial will, or the Truett family that owns all the Chick-fil-A's, which of those two wills are you going to pick? If you don't know the answer, I'll help you figure it out. It's not mine, okay? That family's estate and wealth is much more substantial than ours. That's what you're getting with this picture of this blessing, is a perspective of that much capacity. And it's even deeper when you think about some of the terms that are used. It is kind of multicolored rather than monochrome in God's care. It has his countenance, that's his kind of attitude or behavior. It has a connection to God that's really powerful. We're going to talk about it in a second in the way that he's described. And the end of it is that God grants peace to you. So from the idea of a shining face, did Israel have any inclination of what a face that had been close to God would be like? Yeah, how'd that make them respond? Fearful, terrified. Right. The picture of God not being willing to look on them was another factor. And so you go back in the text, verse 25, the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. It's more than just that lightness of care. God's soft hand. Because this is a picture of great power, too. If they were afraid of Moses, who had the after a glow, if you will, of God's presence on him, when they say, the priests, the high priest and his sons say, hey, God's going to make his light shine upon you, that's pretty intense glare, if you will, but it's not mean at all. It's great power. It's like a spotlight illuminating everything around you. And so there's a little bit more in that richness and significance than just, hey, you know, God's got your back. You know, you've got capacity there. In three lines, you have a framework that introduces a number of aspects of God's grand care. And there's something else that you can't get it in the English language, but in the way in which this particular poem lays out, I want to stop for a second and give you two tips for understanding the poetry or music of the Old Testament. There are a couple of things that are really valuable. The number one thing is that because of the language barrier and the lack of a musical nomenclature for us to draw to, most of what we're looking at is more about poetry of ideas rather than poetry of melody. Most of the songs we like them because of the melody. Or I go, dun, 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 dun. That starts a song in your head, maybe. Maybe you're thinking about, if the skies are, you know, the rest of the song, and it starts jumping in your head. You guys all know the rest of it. Hebrew poetry and Hebrew musicality is all about the ideas. And the ideas create rhyme and rhythm. The most common one is chiasm, and that's an X shape. But this is more of a telescope or a progression form. It's kind of like a haiku, if you know what haikus are. But you don't have to, because it's not exactly that, and it's not so awkward. In this particular form, there are, as the way it's laid out, three words, five words, seven words. It expands. And in the syllabic layout, it's 12, 14, and 16. And then if you go to consonants, it is 15, 20, and 25 in each of these three sentences. So if you're looking for mathematical organization and melody by math, which is part of Hebrew poetry, it's got it all. It's got all of those pieces. But it also branches forth from a basic idea. Verse 1, the Lord bless you and keep you. That's the 24. Verse 26, the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So it further continues to expand that core message. And the last point I wanted to emphasize from this section of the text is who God chose to convey it. Is Aaron and his sons like really super awesome in their relationship with Israel and God, with him in the middle? Like this perfect, best relationship ever? No, we have at least two illustrated big issues that both Israel and God are aware of in the text. God's aware of all of it beyond the text, but written out for us. Golden calf, right? The bitter pill of gold, the golden calf. And then you have the incidents from chapter 8 to chapter 10 of Leviticus, which culminated in the offer of strange fire on the basis of his sons. And then all of Israel saw their dead bodies go out. And so it's an interesting selection from that standpoint for us learning that God has Aaron still as the high priest and now giving this very memorable blessing. One of the easy parallels that you could make is someone from the New Testament that had a pretty messy background and then God used them in a special way. You know, you're talking about Saul, who we know is Paul. And the interesting part about Saul by its comparison, of the apostles of the New Testament, how many of them had the academic background of Paul? Like who were really good with the Hebrew Scriptures? None of them did. And so you're looking for an expert in the Hebrew life and maybe to teach people about God and send them out to the Hebrews. That's Paul, right? Because he knows everything. He knows everybody. Is that what God uses him for? Paul tries to do that, and like Roy points out, God keeps pushing him the other way. He says, no, you're an apostle to the Gentiles. But I trained my whole life to be, you're over here. Aaron, great spokesman. He's actually in a cardboard cutout-esque role, as he's shown to us, serving and providing just whatever it is that God needs for him to do in that role. And even more so, Israel sees his flaws too. And he still steps up and serves. The work that his sons had engaged in was well known. And as that service continued, God continued to make use of him in any way necessary. I just think it's a neat little aspect of this particular section of the text to think about who it is, God's use of it, some of the poetic aspects. By the way, that form of poetry you see there, if you'll notice in your Psalms, if you're reading through the Psalms ever, a lot of them are laid out in that same format. You can see that mathematical structure appear. Because generally speaking, the English translations kind of keep that same stretching of the letters, and you can see that each of these verses get a little bigger. Especially if you decide to read the Psalms from the NIV, which probably does that layout the best. Translation is not always the best in some ways, but the NIV does a really good job with the structured layout of the Old Testament Psalms. Like just the way that they order the words and order the breakout of each of the verses. Any questions or comments from that last little section? Tim? Yeah, let's poke over there real quick. There's no reason not to. We've got just a little bit of extra time in my agenda. So over to the Psalms, Psalm 66. 67, is it? And we can read those seven verses. Bobby, do you want to read for us? Psalm 67, verses 1 through 7. Now you think about the expansion that comes from the initial introduction, if you will. May God be gracious to us and bless us and make His face shine upon us. Well, if you back up for a second and you go to verse 24, and you've got that beginning of that psalm in your mind. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up His countenance upon you and give you peace. That's one of those intricate tie-ins that, again, have its deepest understanding if you remember what God's backstory is. Without all that work of God, both Psalm 67, Numbers 6 here is kind of like labeling on a box of laundry soap. It's all promises. And every year they put out a new label on the front of it and they say new and improved. Now with more stain-removing power, extra gluten-free soap added. That's the new kind of things, And every year, right? And in the end, it's pretty much soap. It smells a little different, perhaps. And maybe it's a little better. But in the picture of God's rich grace and rich involvement with these people, and compassionate care and strong support, and sometimes even the terror of the Lord. This big picture that comes in play, these two passages that seem knitted together, then are covering over a nice larger package. You understand what's on the inside of it a little bit more too. Chapter 7 is our next little chunk here. And a couple things are of importance to us. One, the general tenor of this chapter is really simple. It's giving and receiving the best. That's the basic idea of this part of the text. It is in the same basic length of words as one other portion of the Bible, Psalm 119. They're about the same numbering of words, about the same length. Psalm 119 has shorter verses and more of them. But overall, this chapter and chapter Psalm 119 are the ones you don't want to agree to memorize to recite for a test. It's going to be the longest task involved. That being said, there's a lot that's really good in both of those contexts. This is another section of the scriptures that we sometimes might accidentally fly over. That we could probably, pause for a second and dig a little deeper into. And so we're going to do a little bit of that here tonight. There are, we're going to break it down to a few sections. The latter section that picks up around verse 12 breaks down sequentially these various gifts that God is going to be the recipient of. before we do that, we've got the beginning part of the text, which starts in verse 1, and some of the other aspects of it. Hold on a second. Catch up here. All right, so starting with around verses 1 through 4 is our first chunk of text. Let's go ahead and read that together. Les, could you do that for us? Chapter 7, verses 1 through 4. All right, so one thing I'll highlight real quick, verses 5 through 16, which jump after this text, you'll notice if you go back to the census that was performed, a repeat of names. These are the same heads, if you will, that are connected to this task. And often we kind of miss those small details. But step back for a second. We're talking about our first encounter with the picture of all of Israel being accounted for. We say numbered, but they're kind of rallying together. And they've arrayed themselves around the tabernacle. They've placed themselves according to God's design. They have their standards. Remember, all of them have their own flags or standards lift up, and they're identifying these large groups. That's the backdrop for the next offering. We kind of scoot emotionally from that through these dialogues to this. So everyone is all excited about what's about to happen. And now you have a return where these various family units, they're identified as being the heads of the tribes, the heads of the clans, the groups, are going to be bringing these offerings. And think first, from Mount Sinai and back, offerings given unto God fall into a broad spectrum. Some of them are rejected. Can you think of a few of the times when God rejected offerings? Cain. Okay, so that's certainly a significant one. Malachi. What else? What other rejected offerings? Saul is king. He's trying to make an offering. How about this? Any of the kings or folks talk about making an individual offering to God and where their part was in it? Right. And his particular statement was he could not offer to God that which cost him nothing. And so he understood there was a value to it. So you have offerings rejected. You have David recognizing value in the offering, that there's a reason that his connection to it is there. You have people who offered to God and they were in the wrong place, the wrong spot, wrong role. In this case, these families are right place, right time, and will recognize that these are quality offerings. They would fit the criteria of both being of the first fruit era, quality type, but also certainly that would cost them a lot. And the Bible doesn't always note those things for us on the dollar value. Here's a great illustration of it. Think about David and Samson. Not David and Samson, David and Goliath. Sorry. My brain's a little bit off sort there for a second. Thinking about two different stories for a moment. That will come up later. Goliath. What's the thing we remember about Goliath the most? How big he was. And maybe that he was a trained from his youth for war. You ever think about what is described as his weapons of war? Okay, so he's got a spear, shield, and an armor too. Do you realize how expensive his armor was? Like, There's not a number I can come up with off the top of my head to describe how insanely valuable the armor that just he was carrying was worth. So much bronze in an era and time where bronze was basically like the rarest substance that they have for that purpose. And he's got like all of it. You want to think in terms of where this balance was? His armor and weaponry, probably it was equivalent to all of the armor that he was facing on the other side of the field, value dollar-wise. Why did he have that much? Why would Goliath be the one granted the privilege of so much economic value in his armor? Yeah, he had earned it. He didn't have it because he was a scrub on the bench. You know, like, yeah, we'll have you on the team. He had it because he had earned it over time. I think the spear that he was carrying had 15 pounds in its spearhead. You don't give that to someone who's not worthy. Let alone, you know, the spear itself had like a 2.5 inch circumference. Remember right from the translation of the text? That's all that size and space. 15 pounds on the head, a giant shaft. It's because he was worthy. That's why he had it all. And to us, when we read it, by comparison to the shepherd young man, he's not a kid trained for war. It doesn't matter how big Goliath is. He was certainly imposing and a man trained to fight. And David wasn't. And even though sling stones are about the size of my fist, still wasn't trained for war. That's the size of a sling stone for the Israelites that he would have been using. Still wasn't trained for war. All right, so here's the application. When we come to these gifts that are being offered, they're not offering to God out of their excess. Well, yeah, I did all this, and then I got to the end of the table, and I'd already taken this all off for me, and here's the leftovers. The picture you see in these offerings are coming out of their top-level stuff because of their hearts. The reason I go through all that effort to point it out is because sometimes, for me, and this is just me approaching the text, because it's so much of an unfamiliar environment, we don't live with bulls and goats being offered on a regular basis. Most of the stuff that they're offering seems already foreign and maybe not special to me. But in their context, in their culture, this really was the best of the best. So pause for a second before we read in the next portions that come out and think about what you consider, firstly, to be the best things, not people, things, a different criteria that you have in your life, and you're now putting those onto the wagons. Whether it's emotionally the best or physically the best, doesn't matter. You're putting that on the wagon to be offered to the Lord. That's going to kind of help you understand a portion of it. Another way to think about it is to think about the thing you spend the most time with. You know, maybe it's a favorite car. People don't count right now. People were off the table. So you can't use the people illustration. But things. You know, maybe it's your digital devices because you use them for work. Your computer. Maybe it's your tool shop because you've amassed those tools over 40 years and they're important to you. That begins to give you that picture. Or how about just straight up cash? Or gold? You know, we can visualize gold, right? A bar of gold. I don't care who you are, that's a lot. One bar of gold. That begins to help us frame an understanding of a passage. But sometimes seems like, oh yeah, they gave him some stuff because it's not really relatable. So, you know, for me, I could imagine, you know, putting a 1969 Ford Mustang Fastback up there, the car from my youth that I just thought was the most amazing car ever, and saying, okay. Does that change your perspective of Texas a little bit when you begin to think about those things that they're significant and they're not little? They have some emotional value to them. Beyond that as well, a lot of these things would fall into a very useful category for a traveling people who are still worshiping God. And the one thing that connects back to the earlier chapter of the Nazarite vow is personal sacrifice. The person who takes the Nazarite vow is willing to sacrifice personally to keep the vow going. Tim? Right. The Second Temple period post-return, that great lamentation of the older, aged Israelites that simply went, oh, it was so much more beautiful before. And on a visual sense, it clearly was. But on a practical level, God still dwelled in both. A holy, consecrated space. That was a part that they had trouble reconciling in their minds. Because one looks so much different than the other. Memory does that a lot to us in life too. So picking up verse 5 and following, I'm going to catch a couple details here. Accept these then, that they may be used in the service of the tent of meeting, and give them to the Levites, each man according to his service. So Moses took the wagons and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. Two wagons of, and four oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon according to their service. And four wagons and eight oxen he gave to the sons of Merari, according to their service, under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. But the sons of Kohath, he gave none, because they were charged with the service of the holy things that had been carried on the shoulder. And so you begin to see that next step of delineation of responsibility, that in each of these incremental steps forward, the Levites themselves are being designated as their various tasks. The next phase of the text, picking up around verse 10, 11 or so, we're going to see the 12 princes come back into play, the ones I mentioned before from Numbers chapter 2. They're going to bring an offering to, in essence, engage in the dedication of the tabernacle and to offer, like we used before, the idea of an oblation. That I'm going to give back to God. Here's a gift. I'm giving it to God for His service. And the first prince that arrives to this task is going to be Nashon, the son of Aminadab of the tribe of Judah. And this will be on the first day of the dedicating of the altar. He brings silver, fine flour, oil, gold, and incense. He brought a bullock, a ram, and a lamb for burnt offering, and a goat for sin offering, and 17 animals for peace offerings. In the scope of the size of Israel, the animals aren't really kind of abundant in that sense of like there's a huge number. But the significance of the value of it is really what comes into play. A truth that is universal in the Old Testament is shown here again. That God is never concerned with quantity. He is always concerned with quality. And that's a fact that they'll see even as they're taking the land. And so in this particular case, you begin to see the layout of God seeing those details. The fine flour that's mixed with oil as a grain offering. They now are being able to see some aspects of the promised land in their worship too. Because there's a vast difference in the cultural setting of Egypt versus the cultural setting of Israel and what they can do in that land, what they can grow there. and how their life will be different. Verse 18 is our second day. Remember, we've got a 12-day cycle. We've got 5 minutes, so we're not going to get all 12 days in there. I apologize for that. But he brings the same burnt sin and peace offerings, and these are brought again with that same purpose. And I note again the way in which the text renders these relationships, depending on which translation you're using. King James, ASV, I think the New King James does too. It calls them princes. Some of the other translations uses the term chiefs. That's just a language choice to help identify the relationship. I think probably chief is a little clearer, because until the arrival of the royal line, if you will, there is no king save God in Israel. And they ask for a king like the nations around them. And so you have the insertion of a royal titling and a royal relationship take place. But again, you have that aspect of gifts of physicality. You'll notice this. He offered for his offering one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Again, that's one of those math things where you're like, here's the easiest illustration of it. How many of you drive your cars on the basis of how many kilometers per hour it will drive at? None of us do, right? Because we all use miles per hour. But a lot of the cars have it there. Dealing with shekels is kind of like that for me. I don't really recognize shekels as an imperial method of determining weight. And so I also have to math it out. But again, we're looking at a number that's substantial, pounds, not ounces, of weight given into the service of God's people from the folks that really haven't had the means to get it themselves. Everything they have is coming from where, by the way? Where are they getting this gold and silver from? Yeah. They drew it out of Egypt with them. Now, here's a thing that parallels us. It'll probably be our last comment for tonight. Over in Egypt, they suffered forever as they saw it, generationally. And when God brings them out of Egypt, He gives them the capacity to go into those homes and take, being given to them, all this wealth. And they take it home. They take it home with them. And then they go in the promised land, like, we got all this stuff. How long does it take you to get attached to a dollar that gets in your wallet? The moment it goes in there, like, it's my dollar. You give a dollar to a little kid, like, mine. Yeah. You know, they may not understand the worth of it, how much work, but it's theirs. God comes back and says, we're doing this, here's an offering. They have to give it back. But we just got it. And don't we need it? How are we going to... In our world, that's part of this process in life, because every blessing that we have, every dollar that we end up with, to some degree or another, comes out of the bounty that God provides to us. And the moment it gets into our wallets, no matter what our jobs are, whose money is it? It's ours. We have authority over it. Right? Even though we know where it came from. And we acknowledge God's hand in the process. And then we're asked to cheerfully give it up. Cheerfully return it to Him. It's a great parallel there when you're looking at these Israelites who God even more literally gave, perhaps than us, these great riches. They're giving it right back. Again, with no promise of what the future holds. Like, how are we going to provide for our families when we get there? What are we going to do? This promised land you keep talking about, we've never seen before. We've only heard about it. So there's a lot that goes on the back end of their level of understanding that draws them to this point. But we'll get into more of that hopefully on Sunday morning. Thanks, everybody.